Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, June 10th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on Smith & Wesson Brands Incorporated versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos, which is decided last week by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief. Certainly more brief than his career deserves, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out his impressive full bio at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Joel Nolet, currently serves as an associate at Wiley Ryan LLP, where he advocates on behalf of corporate and individual clients in a broad spectrum of matters, including complex commercial disputes, regulatory issues, statutory interpretation controversies, and constitutional cases. With experience in all phases of litigations, from pre-suit counseling through appeal, and has written briefs in cases before the Supreme Court, the 1st, 2nd, 9th, 11th, and D.C. circuits, and federal district courts. Before coming to Wiley Ryan, Joel clerked for the Honorable Raymond Grunder of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 8th Circuit from 2019 to 2021. And from 2021 to 2022, he clerked for the Honorable Timothy Kelly of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And I will leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that extended portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Joel, the floor is yours.
Kayla, thank you so much for that very kind introduction. And I'm very excited to be able to join and just talk about a really interesting case and a unanimous decision from the court. I will just provide a similar disclaimer to what Kayla provided, which is, of course, to the extent that I express any of my own opinions, they are precisely that. They are not any clients. They are not my firm's or anyone else's. So, but with that caveat, we'll say we had the privilege of being able to file an amicus brief in this case on behalf of some firearms industry members, and the case presented a number of very interesting issues, and the court addressed one of the big ones, and we'll get to that momentarily. But just to provide by way of background, some more table setting for those who may not have followed the case yet to this point. But in the 1990s and early 2000s, in the United States, state governments, municipalities were to try to do something about gun violence that they were facing. Making no headway, at least in their own estimation, on gun policy issues in legislatures, either state or federal. They decided to bring lawsuits against gun manufacturers and gun other firearms industry participants, and bringing kind of novel tort claims and tort theories to try to essentially impose liability on them and be able to recover expenses from them for general problems of gun violence committed by third parties in their respective jurisdictions. Congress took note of this and recognizing that it presented serious problems for Second Amendment rights, particularly, and just the general separation of powers, more broadly speaking, enacted the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act in 2005, and what the I'll refer to as PLACA or the PLCAA, or the Act. But what the Act does is it provides firearms industry members of various kinds, an immunity from suit from precisely these sorts of lawsuits. The Act does contain certain exceptions to basically still allow lawsuits against bad actors in the ordinary course. But specifically, there are express findings that Congress included that are codified in the Act, where Congress took note of these lawsuits and expressed concerns about how they impair the individual right to keep and bear arms, because of course if you go after gun manufacturers, individuals won't be able to acquire them. because there'll be less manufacturing or no manufacturing at all. So, and Congress in those express findings also, took note of the separation of powers concerns with parties basically trying to regulate through tort law, and asking common law courts through common law claims to essentially, regulate in a manner that legislatures, both the state and federal level, had in many instances deliberately chosen not to regulate. Parties would be seeking certain remedies that legislatures had considered to impose as a matter of public policy and chose not to. So that is the sort of the state of affairs. This is the background against which the act is adopted in 2005. Fast forward to 2021, and the country of Mexico, dealing with problems of cartel violence that have plagued that country, decided to file a lawsuit in the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts against a number of gun manufacturers. There's also one gun distributor, but as the Supreme Court kind of noted in its opinion, the Mexico didn't really differentiate between the manufacturers and distributors. So I too will just refer to them as the gun manufacturers who were sued in this case. So Mexico sues a number of gun manufacturers. The lead defendant was Smith & Wesson, and there were seven others, I think, for eight total. But it sues them, act notwithstanding, and brings a number of tort claims and attempting to hold those manufacturers liable, largely in tort. There were certain other claims, but the tort ones are the ones that matter here. And Mexico sued them to try to hold them liable for the gun violence that Mexico is facing from the cartels across the border in Mexico. So the manufacturer defendants moved to dismiss in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts. And of course, one of the issues that they raised was the act, which gives them sort of a general immunity from suit for precisely this sort of lawsuit with very narrow exceptions. Mexico responded by pointing to what is referred to as the predicate exception. Again, I mentioned previously that there were some carve outs in the act. One of these is the predicate exception, and the relevant language of the predicate exception is that if the defendant is alleged to have knowingly violated a statute that is applicable to the sale or marketing of firearms, and that statutory violation was the proximate cause of the plaintiff's alleged harm, then a suit can proceed. And Mexico, pointing to this predicate exception, said that their case fit within that exception based upon their, they had various allegations. It was actually quite a voluminous complaint, but they were essentially blaming the manufacturers in short for making conscientious decisions with respect to how they designed and marketed their firearms and to whom they distributed their firearms, ultimately down the stream of commerce. They made decisions while having the knowledge that there were certain bad actor dealers who were engaged in illegal sales of firearms to straw purchasers and the like, who would then carry those firearms across the border. The firearms would end up in the hands of cartels, and the cartels would then use them to commit the acts of violence that Mexico is claiming constituted its harms for which it was seeking relief. So that was essentially the gist of Mexico's case and why they argued that their allegations fit within the predicate exception. The district court disagreed, although for slightly different reasons than what the Supreme Court ultimately decided. But it held that, yes, in fact, the act barred the lawsuit, and so Mexico couldn't bring it. Mexico appealed that to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit reversed. And with respect to these two prongs about the knowing violation of the statute and that violation being the proximate cause of the harms that the plaintiff claims, the First Circuit ruled in favor of Mexico on both. On the knowing violation prong of the predicate exception, the First Circuit reasoned that through an aiding and abetting theory, under basic aiding and abetting principles, an aider and abettor is considered an accomplice. In accomplice liability, you are treated as if you were the principal. And so through aiding and abetting a wrongful act or a statutory violation in case of the predicate exception, you are just as guilty of that violation, at least in the eyes of the law. as a general matter. And so through an aiding and abetting theory that these manufacturers through those design and manufacturing and marketing and distributing decisions, the fact that they had knowledge of bad actors downstream in the stream of commerce from them doing things, and the manufacturer defendants didn't change their actions. They didn't take steps to prevent those bad actors from doing what they were doing. That was enough, according to the First Circuit, to establish aiding and abetting liability for purposes of the knowing violation prong of the predicate exception. And the First Circuit also found that those knowing violations, the aiding and abetting of the knowing violations, did in fact, you know, at least as alleged, constitute the proximate cause of the harms that Mexico alleged. It adopted a rather broad, the Supreme Court didn't reach it, but I guess just speaking for myself, rather broad view of foreseeability, which is, proximate cause is a bit of a chameleon, and what it means depends on maybe the context or the jurisdiction, the court in which you're in, and how it's been applied. But the First Circuit went with a very broad view of what proximate cause constitutes within the meaning of the act, as that term is used in the act, and said that basically just foreseeability was enough. The manufacturer defendants, according to Mexico's allegations, it was doing all these things, the manufacturing and design decisions that made their guns attractive, and the marketing decisions that made their guns attractive, and you know, selling to these bad actor, dealers downstream of commerce. It was, doing all these things with the knowledge that these guns were going to end up in the hands of the cartels in Mexico. And that was enough. That was foreseeable. Ipso facto, proximate cause was satisfied. So with the First Circuit's decision against them, the gun manufacturer defendants then petitioned for cert to the Supreme Court and asked the Supreme Court to decide both of these prongs of the predicate exception, whether the supposed aiding and abetting liability theory that Mexico is relying on to establish the knowing violation within the predicate exception, whether what Mexico alleged was enough, in fact, to constitute aiding and abetting liability, and then whether what they alleged was enough to show proximate cause, whether the First Circuit was right that this very broad foreseeability standard governed the proximate causation analysis, as that term is used in PLACA. Supreme Court took up both questions. It granted cert, and it heard oral argument just a bit earlier this year, let's say end of February. And we just got the decision. We got the decision on Thursday, and a unanimous Supreme Court and an opinion by Justice Kagan disagreed with the First Circuit, and so reversed the First Circuit, agreed with the bottom line conclusion that the district court had reached, which is that, yes, the act does, in fact, bar this lawsuit, and the predicate exception does not apply in these circumstances based upon the allegations in Mexico's complaint. The Supreme Court did not reach both of the questions presented by the manufacturer defendants, though. They only addressed, in the majority opinion, this aiding and abetting theory. So for purposes, again, of the predicate exception, to establish the knowing violation, Mexico relied on this aiding and abetting theory, and the Supreme Court only addressed that in the majority opinion. The bottom line conclusion is that, of course, the Supreme Court said that the Mexico's allegations and its complaint did not suffice to show aiding and abetting liability. While this case was kicking around in the lower courts, the Supreme Court issued a very important decision that was referenced throughout the majority opinion, called Twitter versus Tomney. I believe I'm pronouncing that right, and apologies if anyone's listening who that is their name, and I'm not. But Twitter versus Tomney, and in that case, the petitioners or the plaintiffs were trying to hold Twitter liable for acts of terrorism. The plaintiffs had been victims of terrorism, and they were trying to hold Twitter liable on a theory of aiding and abetting liability for an underlying crime, based on Twitter's alleged awareness that the terrorists were using the Twitter platform to make their plans and whatnot. And despite having that knowledge and being aware that there were bad actors on the platform using it to malicious ends, Twitter did nothing to stop them. And in that decision in Twitter versus Tomney, the Supreme Court said that is not enough to establish aiding and abetting liability. Aiding and abetting liability typically requires some sort of affirmative act and an intent, a desire to see the end result brought about. And mere inaction, such as what Twitter was accused of in that case, of being aware of wrongdoing on its platform and not doing enough to stop it, a mere inaction of that sort was not enough. And the Supreme Court here in the Smith and Wesson case basically said, see our opinion in Twitter, and that controls here. They walked through the key allegations in Mexico's complaint and pointed out how throughout all Mexico was alleging at bottom was exactly this sort of mere inaction. Again, they were saying that the business practices that the gun manufacturers who had been sued were already engaging in, you know, how they manufacture and design, certain firearms and how they market certain firearms that allegedly made these firearms more attractive to cartels. These were things that the companies were already doing. And it's not enough to, for aiding and abetting purposes to say that, well, they were aware that, that was sort of creating an environment that was, encouraging these illegal sales and ultimately the cartel violence, way downstream. But that is just the awareness coupled with doing what you're already doing is just of that mere inaction variety that does not suffice to show aiding and abetting liability. Mexico had a number of counter arguments and they relied heavily on one case in particular from the 1940s. I forget the full name, but the direct sales case, the majority opinion devoted some time to discussing how that case was distinguishable. Mexico tried to rely on that case to fit its allegations within what that case said was sufficient to show aiding and abetting liability, but the court distinguished that case. At bottom, just to summarize the direct sales case, an individual had been convicted who was distributing opiates to a dealer, and the dealer was then engaged in illegal drug trafficking, and the person who was selling the opiates was held liable on a theory of aiding and abetting that drug trafficking, and the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction, saying that his conduct sufficed. But in the majority opinion here in Smith and Wesson, the Supreme Court explained that the reason why aiding and abetting liability was permitted and was found applicable in the direct sales case was because the manufacturer, if you will, in that instance, was engaged in such aberrational conduct with the volume of sales that of opiates and the marketing was not just doing what the person was always doing, but in fact strong arming the drug trafficker in several ways to affirmatively encourage the drug trafficker to do that very thing, to traffic drugs. And of course, again, if aiding and abetting liability turns at bottom on some sort of affirmative act with the intent to bring about the end result, the criminal misconduct that lies at the end of the chain of actions, that checked the box. The fact pattern in direct sales checked the box, but it contrasted that to Mexico's allegations, which once again were simply of the mere inaction variety. So that was the long and the short of the Supreme Court's decision, the majority opinion in the Smith and Wesson case. Again, it addressed the aiding and abetting liability prong of the predicate exception and that theory of liability here. It did not reach the proximate causation question, which was also presented. The decision was unanimous, but Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson both wrote very short concurrences separately, but certainly of interest, and especially of interest moving forward in any cases implicating the act. Justice Thomas wrote to highlight his concerns about the meaning of the term violation. Again, the predicate exception requires showing a knowing violation of some sort of firearm statute. And Justice Thomas, kind of nodding to folks who are in the criminal sentencing world, are familiar with the categorical approach and the modified categorical approach and all that, but he nodded to kind of similar concerns that the statute talks about a violation, and courts have kind of either glossed over that or assumed that the allegations of some sort of predicate violation sufficed to be able to state a claim, notwithstanding the bar of the act, fit their case within the predicate exception so that it could proceed. And Justice Thomas encouraged courts and suggested that mere allegations of a violation might not be enough for purposes of being able to state a claim, notwithstanding the bar of PLACA. Rather, there would have to be some sort of prior adjudication of a violation of a firearm statute in order for a subsequent lawsuit, bringing tort claims against a gun manufacturer, the like, in order for that sort of lawsuit to be able to get over the bar of the act. And he expressed concerns that Taylor versus United States, the seminal decision adopting the categorical approach for sentencing enhancements in the criminal context. But he echoed those concerns that come up in that context and why we have the categorical approach to begin with. You know, the idea that in a civil lawsuit, it would be adjudicated under a preponderance of the evidence standard that this defendant was guilty of, you know, a statutory a violation of some firearm statute, which in many instances will have criminal consequences. That just, it raises significant due process and constitutional concerns. He didn't go so far in his concurrence, Justice Thomas, in his concurrence to say decisively one way or another that he would view that as unconstitutional, but it's certainly of concern. And so he wrote separately to flag this issue so that, you know, hopefully in his estimation that litigants will be attuned to it and courts will be attuned to it and the issue will get worked out. Justice Jackson also wrote a short separate concurrence, and she wrote to flag that, you know, one of the core problems with Mexico's allegations was, again, focusing on this knowing violation requirement within the predicate exception. She wrote to highlight that Mexico just didn't have any plausible allegations of what the actual knowing violation was. The majority opinion was focused on the aiding and abetting question about whether or not the allegations were sufficient to show that the defendants in this case had aided and abetted some principal, misconduct, knowing violation of a firearm statute. But the Justice Jackson wrote to point out that the plaintiffs didn't identify with plausible factual allegations who did those actual principal violations, when they did them, what they constituted. There were some general allegations in the complaint about these bad apple firearms dealers somewhere, in proximity to the Texas-Mexico border who were engaged in illegal sales. But Mexico did not point the finger at anything in particular and say, this particular illegal sale, was aided and abetted by the gun manufacturers. Justice Jackson also, she closed on at least in my view, is a very high note, but the majority opinion had nodded to some of the bigger themes lurking in the background and the reasons why the act was passed in the first place, which was to prevent common law courts from essentially functioning as firearms regulators when legislators and their delegees and agencies had in many instances deliberately decided not to adopt certain policies or enact certain firearms regulations. And Justice Jackson ended her concurrence with just a nod to this issue that ultimately Mexico's complaint was precisely the sort of lawsuit that PLACA was meant to bar. And it was essentially an attempt to ask common law courts through common law principles to step into the shoes of public policymakers, primarily legislatures, and impose through tort liability regulations that legislatures had, again, in many instances, deliberately chosen not to adopt. So that is Smith and Wesson. The follow-on issues, there are some cases pending currently. I read a statement from, I believe it was one of the attorneys for Mexico in this case, but there's other active litigation elsewhere. In some cases, they're going after the dealers themselves, in those cases, it'll be interesting just to keep an eye on them to see if any of these kind of follow-on questions, if the issue of proximate causation comes up again that the Supreme Court did not reach, and if in particular, like the issue that Justice Thomas flagged in his concurrence about, does the requirement of a knowing violation require prior adjudication or are allegations sufficient? These issues will get worked out in the months and years to come. So those will be cases to watch.
Well, Well, thank you so much for that summary of this case, especially as it's at this interesting intersection of kind of criminal law, kind of international law, touching on administrative law, at least in its ramifications, and then federalism and separation of powers. Really interesting case, and I appreciate you summing up how we got here, the decision, and as well as the concurrences. Moving to a time of Q&A, I'll issue a reminder to our audience that if you have questions, you can submit those via the question and answer feature. And as those come in, I'd love to kick things off with a couple questions of my own, starting with sort of a general question on the opinions and the way they were framed. Were there any arguments or questions you were surprised to see raised in any, either the opinion or the concurrences, or arguments that you were surprised not to see pop up?
Yeah, I can't say that there were really any surprises, at least to me. Maybe one thing I could say along these lines, and I'm not going to fully do it justice because it wasn't really a live issue anymore, but the district court, as I alluded to, it held the PLACA barred the lawsuit, but it did so on slightly different grounds. The district court reasoned kind of in a nutshell that to trigger the predicate exception, your cause of action has to be whatever the knowing violation pertains to. So, you know, you have a knowing violation of a firearm statute, your cause of action has to kind of arise under that firearm statute or otherwise, you know, be sufficiently related. So, you know, the rationale being that a generic tort claim for negligence, you couldn't bring that within the parameters of the predicate exception because the predicate exception required your cause of action to be you violated this firearm statute and that harmed me in some way, shape, or form. As I recall, the First Circuit rejected that, obviously, and ultimately reversing. But I believe several courts have answered this question, and generally the answer has been that's not right. That the way that the predicate exception reads is you can have any kind of claim just to be able to pursue that claim. You know, the facts underlying that claim have to consist of what the predicate exception describes. There's a knowing violation of a firearm statute that proximately causes your harm. So a negligence claim is actionable within the predicate exception, you know, so long as you check the boxes otherwise. You know, that, like I said, it wasn't really a live issue. The questions presented in the cert petition didn't touch on that. But, you know, it is another interesting issue that is out there about how the act is properly interpreted and applied.
Got it. Touching on the questions that were that did come to the court in this case, you mentioned we only got answered to one of the two. It's sort of we got to aiding and abetting, got our answer there, then we're done. Now that proximate cause is hanging out there, what ramifications could that have for future suits in this vein?
Well, you know, most immediately, I mean, you know, the First Circuit was reversed, but its proximate cause analysis wasn't touched. So at the very least, just putting on my clerk hat, you know, for a minute, I suspect that district courts in the First Circuit are going to look at the First Circuit's decision in this case and at least look at the proximate cause analysis and say, well, it's not. You know, the analysis isn't bad law. The First Circuit's decision might be bad law. It got reversed, but the analysis wasn't touched, and so that's not necessarily bad law. And I know how the First Circuit's going to think about this most likely next time it goes up. You know, the First Circuit in particular is a very small circuit, so the odds of you getting a pretty similar panel are high. At minimum, I think district courts in the First Circuit and eventually maybe the First Circuit again might double down on the proximate cause analysis. You know, that said, I do think that there are a number of propositions that come, you know, verbatim from the opinion that militate against the First Circuit's, you know, again, rather broad foreseeability test. You know, in particular, these considerations, like I said, that the majority opinion nodded to, Justice Jackson really put a fine point on, you know, in terms of the last concurrence. So it was a nice way to kind of just end everything, end all the opinions. But this idea that, again, we're going to resort to common law principles and essentially common law courts, even if you're in federal court, you know, sitting in diversity to, you know, apply these common law claims. And so they're functioning as common law adjudicators. You're asking common law courts to do things. Just to give one concrete example, you know, there's extensive regulation about serial numbers on firearms. And yeah, policies vary at the federal and state level and across the states and whatnot. But federal law, you know, obviously preempts state law, and state law is in conflict. But this is an area in which legislatures have spoken, and they've spoken specifically, and they've prescribed certain things and not other things about the nature and quality of the serial numbers that go on firearms, get printed on firearms. But you know, criminals often will file off the serial number so the guns become untraceable. And one of the remedies that plaintiffs sought previously, and Mexico is seeking in this case, was essentially asking the court to require these firearms manufacturers to adopt better kind of imprinting technology. Either imprinting the bullet or there are some other options that at least in theory are out there. Whether or not they're practical is a different question, and perhaps that was kind of the point in seeking this remedy. But they were asking for a court in adjudicating a common law claim of negligence to order the defendants to adopt this practice in their manufacturing practices moving forward, where the legislature has already spoken in that field and said you had to do X, but you don't have to do Y. And so, that big picture principle that, again, you know, it popped up in the majority opinion and Justice Jackson really drove it home. I do think that you'll see parties citing this case, even if disputing the scope of proximate cause and the predicate exception, they'll be looking to those principles that the court leaned on. Because, as I mentioned, proximate causation can be a bit of a chameleon, doctrinally speaking. Courts, around the country have come up with all sorts of different ways of articulating what is the test, and they're typically very, they don't do much better. The definition of proximate cause doesn't do much better than the term itself to describe what constitutes a proximate cause versus what doesn't. But this point that the court makes in the majority opinion and again that Justice Jackson harps on, I think it matters greatly, because common law courts should be looking at the proximate causation standard as codified in the act with a view to this massive regulatory regime, across all levels of federal and state jurisdictions, that public policymakers, in those roles, legislators and their delegees and executive branch actors through enforcement decisions and whatnot, they have made all these choices. And so proximate causation should perhaps, I can imagine the argument will go that proximate causation should be read with a view to all that, and thus read narrowly, so that you can't find a proximate cause, in something that has been affirmatively blessed as permissible, or at least hasn't been made illegal when it has been considered by policymakers.
We got a little bit of that, I think, in the majority opinion, where they touched on the attenuation of the how close is this? Well, this person sells to this person, sells to this person, sells to this person. It also came up a whole bunch in our oral argument, though it obviously wasn't determinative in the case itself as to how close that is. So that will be interesting to see. We have an audience member who, jumping off of the proximate cause conversation, asks, even with the proximate cause analysis not addressed, does Mexico have any serious basis to proceed? Do they plan to continue, or maybe can they continue with their lawsuits against the manufacturers?
That does raise a good question as to the posture of this case in particular. The Supreme Court, held that PLACA barred the suit. So barring something exceptional, this suit is done. The case is dismissed. And whether or not it will proceed against others, if you're talking about a lawsuit, as I mentioned, there are some against the dealers. You cut out several steps in the chain of proximate causation in particular, but also you make an aiding and abetting liability theory, more straightforward than what the court had before in this case, which was this, multi-chain stream of commerce, and the people basically at one end of the stream of commerce were being sued about the misconduct of people, several steps away from them in the chain and pretty far downstream from them in that stream of commerce. So, suits against illegal dealers or dealers who are engaged in illegal firearm sales will present kind of a very different fact pattern entirely. Time will just tell if this is the end of the line for this attempt to kind of revive the very types of litigation that the act was enacted to prohibit, or if they try to color within the lines, the newly defined lines by the Smith and Wesson opinion, and see if there are other ways that they could still pursue kind of these novel and attenuated theories, notwithstanding Smith and Wesson.
Touching on where the lines are drawn, there was some discussion in oral argument as to whether or not Twitter and direct sales created like a dichotomy. You could either be on the Twitter side or you can be on the direct sales side. Does this case clarify that at all? I don't know if there was actual controversy or just we're arguing our best case before the Supreme Court. But given that the majority opinion addressed both, it seems that we might have some clarity as to the extent of each precedent.
Yeah, no, I think the Supreme Court made very clear that it didn't see any tension. I mentioned that they distinguished direct sales, but they very much, as I read the majority opinion, they very much viewed direct sales as completely of a piece. And the court had analyzed direct sales. It came up in the Twitter case, unless I'm misremembering and misplacing. But it's not the first time that. It's had occasion, but in this opinion in particular, I felt like the majority opinion said, no, these are just, they're two perfectly harmonious, applications of these underlying principles. It's just in one, you had all the right facts to be able to find aiding and abetting liability. And in the other, you didn't have those facts. And so there was no aiding and abetting liability. Obviously Mexico was relying heavily on direct sales and dressed up its complaint in those terms. But the Supreme Court just said, this case doesn't help you. In fact, I think at some point it came out kind of directly and said that.
Yes. Fair enough. Okay, so this case is obviously over. They can't move forward, given that they have no standing. But other than for the actual parties in the case, what will be the immediate impact of this decision? Are there other cases currently ongoing that could be affected by this decision?
Yeah, as I mentioned, there are a number of other active lawsuits that touch on the act and implicate it to some degree or another. To the extent that these defendants in particular or others similarly situated to them, who are on one far end of the chain within this stream of commerce. Those lawsuits are wherever they are in the pipeline, if they haven't yet been decided, things will likely not fare well moving forward. If they have been decided, and if they've been decided in a way contrary to the principles that Smith and Wesson has articulated, you can very likely expect a GVR in the near future from the cert petition that gets filed saying, you just held to the contrary. There are a host of fact patterns, and it very much depends on who the defendant is and what they're accused of. The one flip side, although, the Supreme Court in the majority opinion, made rather clear what doesn't qualify for aiding and abetting liability, did repeatedly come back to, and rightly so, this was up on a motion to dismiss posture. And so it was the allegations of the complaint that mattered. But even so, the Supreme Court repeatedly turned to Mexico's allegations and focused on, what Mexico did not do to cross the threshold, to be able to show aiding and abetting liability. And so, the next plaintiff could very well come along and do what they can within the bounds of Rule 11 to include all those allegations that the court found lacking in Mexico's complaint and was the basis for the court's ultimate decision to hold that Mexico's complaint failed to clear the bar. So, again, who the defendants are and whatnot will matter, I think, extraordinarily. Plenty of follow on litigation. This might just, as is so often the case, it might leave more doors open than it does close. But we at least got clarity in this one particular, aspect of this one particular component of the act.
Fair enough. Well, I typically sort of, as we're moving toward the end of our program, ask sort of zoom out and ask broader questions about other industries, areas of law that should be paying attention. And I'll ask it, although if the answer is, hey, this is a highly cabined case with highly specific facts that has a law that particularly pertains to the gun industry, that also works as the answer. But what downstream effects of this could there be? And what other industries or areas of law should be paying attention, not just to how this decision came out, but to the way the justices came to that conclusion?
Yeah, this is one of those cases where I think is, it actually is quite the opposite of a cabin's narrow issue, because the, you know, aiding and abetting liability is a principle that, you know, the law is rife with, across all variety of industries and subject matters, those principles matter. In fact, several of the amici in the case who were supporting the petitioners, the gun manufacturer defendants, their briefs are focused on how if this is enough, if what Mexico has alleged is enough to establish aiding and abetting liability, beverage manufacturers are going to be, found liable under theories of aiding and abetting liability for obesity problems that cities and states and whichever government entities are responsible for healthcare, their added expenses because of, obesity problems from, the excess consumption of high fructose corn syrup. That would be, one negative consequence had the Supreme Court ruled otherwise. And there are a number of other car manufacturers when it comes to, misuse of cars. And you could just go down the line, pick an industry, this affects them. And the decision, does provide some helpful clarity. On the heels of the Twitter versus Tomney decision, which had already set, again, a lot of these parameters and benchmarks. But this decision does provide some more clarity and thus some more regulatory certainty about what manufacturers and business actors in a variety of contexts, they can plan their conduct accordingly and know that they're not exposing themselves to liability simply for engaging in conduct they're already engaged in, putting a product in the stream of commerce, on the off chance, and God forbid, but somebody downstream, uses it in a criminal way and does something terrible, they can at least know that aiding and abetting liability is not one likely risk that they are facing from their actions.
Fair enough. Well, barring any questions from our audience, I'll turn it over to you for a set of final comments, and then we can wrap slightly early and give people back a section of their afternoons. Oh, speaking of, audience question, well done. How does this case influence future ACCA cases where the plaintiffs allege violation of consumer protection or in truth marketing statutes to gun manufacturers under the ACCA predicate exception?
Yeah, I think this is kind of what we've been touching on. It's very much going to depend because the Supreme Court left open, the proximate cause point that will is an open issue in any jurisdictions where it hasn't been decided already, and this question about a knowing violation, the issue that Justice Thomas has flagged, it's a very interesting one. I suspect we'll see a lot of litigation about that. Justice Thomas does have a knack. His concurrences do tend to inspire litigants, I don't think this case will be any different. And I think it's a really challenging question in no small part because the categorical approach has been heavily, heavily criticized kind of across the ideological spectrum, on substantive grounds, as well as workability concerns and the like. But nevertheless, It is the law of the land, and the concerns that the court identified to adopt the categorical approach in the first instance in Taylor versus United States, they are certainly very valid. And the oddity of adjudicating in a civil context, the somebody's commission of criminal misconduct, what does that mean? It does seem to create many, many due process questions. So I think that might be the big development, how courts are grappling with that, as I suspect more and more defendants raise that as a defense against a lawsuit that tries to come within the predicate exception, and as courts have to answer whether or not the mere allegations of a violation are enough, or if an antecedent adjudication in some way, shape, or form of a knowing violation of a firearm statute will be required in order to be able to pursue this follow-on civil litigation.
Sounds good. Well, final thoughts, summation of the argumentation or case?
No, except just to observe once more that this was a unanimous decision written by Justice Kagan. Plenty of hot button issues kicking around in culture at large and in the courts in particular. And it's really just good. It's good to see that the nine justices were all in complete agreement, because the two concurring justices agreed. They just had some more thoughts that they wanted to share, but all nine justices agreed on this hot button issue, touching on the Second Amendment, touching on firearms rights and gun violence and all that. But what was presented was a question of statutory interpretation, and the court decided a question of statutory interpretation, and it did so unanimously. So that small little civics takeaway for us.
Sounds good. Well, we can wrap it there. Joel, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise and insight, breaking down the case and answering our questions. We really appreciate it. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.